This morning, we're going to do something just a little bit different when it comes to this message. Last week, we talked all about the resurrection of Jesus at Easter time and what the resurrection means, meant, all of those kinds of things. And so this week's kind of a part two, if you will. This morning, I've titled this message, Jesus Changes Everything, to kind of go with that. And some of you may be thinking, Jesus changes everything? Yeah, right. Maybe for some of you, you haven't really seen Jesus change a whole lot in your life. Maybe there are things that are dark and difficult and frustrating to go through, and you haven't seen a whole lot of Jesus there. And if you're a Christian, maybe you think, well, Jesus has changed my life, but the world around me is a messed up, broken place. It's pretty lost. But all throughout the New Testament, we can see story after story where an encounter with Jesus changes lives. And if we look and look hard enough, we can find out that Jesus has indeed changed everything that we know today. So what I'm going to do this morning is that if you look at the back of your program, there are a lot of blanks. Usually there's more words there. I will try and help you fill those in. There's about 10 of them, but I'm going to go through some different categories and take about 90 seconds for each category to explain how Jesus has changed that category. Does that make sense? All right, let's go. So how or what about art? Let's start with art. Imagine if you had a giant vacuum that could suck up all of the great art in the great museums in the world. You could take it to the Louvre, the Metropolitan, the Vatican, the National Gallery in London, and basically this vacuum would suck up any piece of art that had anything at all to do with Jesus. So if it had a cross, a disciple, a church, anything like that in it, it would be gone. And if that happened, nearly half of all the great art in the world would be gone. Because Jesus is the most painted, sculpted, and represented person in human history. That he has inspired more art than anyone else. But then you have music. And without Jesus, you don't have songs like this one. Anybody know it? It says Handel's Messiah. It's a song that was recorded all the way back in 1741. It's a song that was so powerful that King George II spontaneously rose to his feet during a performance. Amazing stuff has been done because of Jesus. And without Jesus, you don't have guys like Johann Sebastian Bach, who would sign each composition with SDG, or Soli Deo Gloria, meaning glory to God alone. Without Jesus, you don't even have musical notes, which were created by Christian monks as a way of praising God. Anyone in the room, can you read music? If you can read music, you have been influenced by Jesus. Today, there are more hymns and songs that have been written about Jesus than any other person in human history, because when people are changed and brought into a right relationship with God, they sing, they paint, and they give him glory in the arts. Second, what about geography? If you were to drop an alien in any big city in the United States, let's say you took out all the people and just gave them the landscape, the geography, the buildings, the street names, etc. In just a few days, I'm sure that that alien would come back to you and ask this question, what or who is this Jesus? Because Jesus has impacted every city in our country. Even in Grand Junction, we can't go more than a couple of blocks without seeing a church or two or three or more. His influence is everywhere. Question for you. Anyone know the oldest town in America? St. Augustine was named after St. Augustine of Hippo, who was an early Christian theologian and philosopher, whose writings influenced the development of Western Christianity and Western philosophy. How about the capital of Minnesota? St. Paul. In 1841, Father Lucien Gaultier was sent to the region to minister to the French Canadians, and he started a church and he named it St. Paul. Or if you head out west to California, do you know what San Diego was named after? Diego of Alcala, a monk known for helping people during the plague. You go up the coast, you have Santa Barbara, which was named after Saint Barbara, a third century Christian who was killed for her faith by her own father. Then you have San Francisco, which is named after Saint Francis, a wealthy man who gave up everything he had to follow Jesus. And in Los Angeles, it literally means city of angels. It's named after the angels who announced the birth of Jesus. In all reality, you can't take a road trip anywhere in this country without seeing some place that has been changed by Jesus. Now, what about gender roles? How many of you in the room believe that men are better than women? Smart move, guys. Smart move. But in Jesus' day, this was the common belief. There were 1.5 million boys to every 1 million girls. Because often when a little girl was born, the parents would discard the baby because they believed in that time that boys were more valuable than girls. There was a letter that came from a Roman soldier to his pregnant wife, and it said, "When you deliver the baby, if it's a boy, then keep it, and if it's a girl, then expose it." This idea of exposure was a very common practice in those days, that parents would take a newborn baby girl, which they considered to be worthless in society's eyes, and they would leave her screaming and crying outside of town somewhere. But then it was Jesus' earliest followers who began reciting from Galatians chapter 3, verse 28, that there is neither Greek nor Jew, male nor female, that all are precious in God's eyes. And it was the Christians who began to take these little girls home and to raise them and to care for them. Now today we have a lot of different things that attribute to women's rights. Did you know that most of the women's rights that we know today were spearheaded by Christian women? In many Eastern countries, women are still seen as second-class citizens, can't even get a driver's license. But if you're a woman that's living in the Western world, which I can hopefully assume that all of you are, you should thank Jesus for the freedoms that you enjoy. And if you remember, we talked about last week when Jesus was raised from the dead, who was it that he appeared to first? It was a woman named Mary. And not that she was more important, but the fact that Jesus tended to break the mold in his dealings with society that went against what everybody else thought, showing the world that everyone, no matter who you are, is included in the kingdom. Now, what about sports? Jesus didn't change sports, did he? Yes, and I'm not just talking about the New Orleans Saints or the Los Angeles Angels. But if you take the NFL draft, for example, the NFL draft was started during the Depression when Burt Bell, the co-owner of the Philadelphia Eagles, persuaded his fellow owners to start this process of selecting college players for their teams. And now, as you might know, if you don't know, in the draft, the team with the worst record gets the first pick. But where did Bell get this idea from? He got it from Jesus' words in Matthew 20, that the last shall be first. And so who does the team who gets the first overall draft pick in the NFL have to thank? Jesus. And if you're a Broncos fan, did you know that John Elway and Peyton Manning were both first-round draft picks? Good things for us. But Jesus also changed baseball. If you can open right up in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "In the big inning." It's a good dad joke. If you saw the movie 42, you'll know the name Branch Rickey, who was played by Harrison Ford. Rickey was the general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, and he was such a devout Christian that he wouldn't even attend baseball games on Sundays. But he believed that God was calling him to integrate baseball. And so he went out and he found Jackie Robinson, the first African-American baseball player. But why would he choose Robinson? Because there were plenty of other talented young players in the Negro League, but he selected him because of his faith in Jesus. If you remember, this was the 1940s that Jackie Robinson would be called names by fans, opposing players would try to hurt him and injure him, and even his own teammates would refuse to room with him if a hotel would allow him to stay there at all. But when the two met for the first time, Rickey invited Robinson to join the Dodgers. He pulls out a Bible and he read Jesus' words from Matthew 5 that says, "If someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other also." And so Robinson followed these words and he changed American baseball and sports as we know it. More contemporary, does anybody know the name Tim Tebow? Tim Tebow, like several other people, have used his influence to share Jesus with people that he encounters, even in the midst of being harassed over and over. And we're not going to get into this debate this morning, but whether you agree it's a sport or not, if anybody pays any attention to NASCAR, it is one of, if not the only sport that still has a public prayer before every single race. Now, what about science? Now, science can't fit, right? Because faith and science just don't go together. But actually, Jesus is part of how science came about in our world. You see, before Jesus came along, the leading philosophers believed that the material world, the earth, was evil. But Jesus taught that God created it, and therefore it was good. And since it was good, the study of it would also be good. So a vast majority of the pioneers of scientists believed in creation, that God was responsible for the order that they observed in the world. It was Francis Bacon who developed the scientific method, said, "God has granted us the ability to know the works of creation and its secrets." Blaise Pascal was a mathematician who was responsible for creating Pascal's wager, which mathematically argues that you should believe in God. He theorized that all people on earth are given a choice, that either God does or God does not exist. And he says, when faced with this choice, the smart bet mathematically is to believe that God does exist. Because if you bet that he doesn't, or that he does exist and he doesn't, then you lose very little. But if you bet that he doesn't exist and he really does, you have everything to lose. Isaac Newton, who developed the theory of gravity, was a devout Christian, and he also wrote a series of commentaries on the book of Revelation. Even this concept of technology and the invention of labor-reducing machines were created by monks who saw a difference between work and toil, the latter being the result of sin. Therefore, using creative reason to liberate people from toil is a part of the redemptive work of Jesus. Now, what about government? Prior to the Christian faith being applied to civil government, people lived in perpetual fear of massacres and tyrants. Your town could be here one day and then be burned to the ground the next. That power and fear ruled human societies for much of human history. But after Jesus, the biblical role of civil government began to emerge through things like the Magna Carta and the British common law, republican governments, democratic principles, and human rights. And these things weren't just the evolutionary march of history. They were incremental applications of Jesus' teachings to human governments. So do you appreciate the armies and the police that protect us? Do you value the right to vote to elect your representatives? Do you appreciate the relative tranquility of a just social order? Because all of these things, which are not enjoyed by many nations in the world, come from the fruit of faith in Jesus. And what about education? In Jesus' day, education wasn't for everyone. It was only for the boys, and it was really only for the wealthy ones that were educated. So how did we end up with this idea of mass education? It was Jesus' followers who heard him say in Matthew 28, "Go and make disciples and teach them." Did you know that we would have lost much of the great literature of Greece and Rome and other civilizations of the ancient world if it were not for the Christian monks who preserved that knowledge through finding, preserving, and copying ancient writings during the Middle Ages? It was the monks who preserved these great writings and passed them down from generation to generation, and who also started the first universities. It seems like the monks did a lot of things, and we like to think weirdly about monks that they just live in caves and have hoods. But there's something about solitude and constant study of God's word that makes a difference. But 92% of the first 138 colleges and universities founded in America were begun for followers of this uneducated, itinerant, never wrote a book carpenter. But it was Christians who started schools like Harvard, Princeton, Brown, Yale. Even the word university means one truth. But the first schools didn't even meet during the school week. In Great Britain in the early 1800s, there was a man named Robert Raikes who couldn't stand the poverty cycle and this idea that the world marches forward on the feet of little children. So he started a school on Sundays, the only free day since most worked in factories, to teach them to read and to write and to learn about God. And within 50 years, there were 1.5 million students, children learning and being taught by 160,000 volunteers. And you know what they called it? Sunday school. What about health care? How many of you have been or know someone who has been in a hospital in the last year? Do you know why we call them hospitals? You have the words of the Apostle Paul in Romans 12. We call them because Christians started them when Paul wrote, "Share with the Lord's people in need and practice hospitality." Because if you got sick in Jesus' day, if you didn't get well soon, your family would literally throw you out on the curb so you didn't infect everybody else. Can you imagine being sick and your family hoisting you up, throwing you outside, and then locking you out? Or if there was enough people in the house that got sick, the healthy ones would leave and lock the sick inside. But it was the Christians who began to knock on the doors of these people, bringing them food and trying to take care of them. They began to take sick people, even those who had been thrown out to die, and they started to add on rooms to their churches to care for them, and they called them hospitality rooms. And in 325 AD at the Council of Nicaea, it was decided that everywhere a church was built, a hospital should also be built. And that's why for so many of you were born in hospitals with names like Baptist Memorial, or St. Francis, St. Luke, St. John, Mercy, Good Samaritan, Presbyterian. Healthcare is not a political idea, it is a Christian idea. Now, what about business? When the development of human work, labor, and industry, even the development of human work, labor, and industry finds success in the application of Christian truth. For most of history, and still in some places in the world, there are only a few wealthy tyrants and then a mass of poor people. For hundreds of years, there was no middle class and no freedom for individual initiative. But during the Christianizing of Europe, this all changed as believers applied biblical concepts of labor and industry, which eventually became free enterprise capitalism that led the world out of its mass poverty. A man named Adam Smith wrote a book called Wealth of Nations, and in it he says, "The large and growing middle classes, the endless business opportunities, the Protestant work ethic, extensive philanthropy, and the standard of living we share today is the fruit of the teachings Christ applied to economics." So when you make your next purchase, you buy your next iGadget, you can thank God for the free enterprise system that you currently enjoy because it's built on faith from start to finish. Now, what about names? I'm going to do something a little bit different. Anybody know the names of the most important biographer of Abraham Lincoln? Or Adolf Hitler? Now, can you tell me the names of the four most important biographers of Jesus? You can say them out loud, it's okay. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now I want to try something. I would like for you to stand up if you or someone in your family is named Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. You won't have to stand long, but if you know somebody, you or someone in your family that is named Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. Now do you realize that you may not even believe in Jesus, but someone you know, someone you live with is named after one of his first followers. You can go ahead and be seated. And it had to be strange for people like Peter and Paul, believers of this little ragtag group they call Christians, to stand before horrible emperors like Caesar and Nero. Because ultimately, the powerful government took the lives of so many early Christians, but 2,000 years later, we name our children Peter and Paul, and we name our dogs Caesar and Nero. But what about me? Me personally? Jesus has drastically changed my life. I can't even begin to think about my life would look like without Jesus, and I really don't want to. I know for me, I've made a lot of mistakes in my own life. I've done things that I shouldn't have, done things that I regret, but I do my best to try and keep Jesus as my priority, my focus. Because the world is a very difficult place. Tensions arise constantly, and I know that even when I am not faithful, He is. And in all the years that I've done things and all the years that I've been married and so many different things that I've experienced, the biggest thing, one of the greatest things I've ever learned from Jesus is this, that there is nothing you can ever do to make God love you any less. Let me say that again. There is nothing you can ever do to make God love you any less. because of my understanding of God's love in my own life, it is my hope and my goal in life to show and share that same love to people that I encounter. Because the truth of the matter is that when you encounter Jesus, you can't not be changed. Something happens, and something for the better. But that's me. And last, what about you? It's the last thing to discuss, because again, you can't meet Jesus and not be changed, and you will never know your true identity until you know who he is. And who is Jesus? He is the man who changed everything. His life has left a permanent mark on everything around us. The influence of Jesus has been seen and felt in the lives of so many people throughout the world for so long, and it's changed the way that they think and they act and they live life. It has literally changed everything around us. Because the world may be a grim place at times, and it doesn't always look like it's going to get any better, but my hope is that you remember the words from the writer of Hebrews chapter 13. It says, "Remember your leaders who spoke the word of God to you. Consider the outcome of their way of life and imitate their faith. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever." Here's the takeaway this morning. How has Jesus changed you? And I know that for some of you, the course of your whole life has been changed because somebody else that you know. You looked at somebody's life and thought, man, there's something different about that person. And you begin to investigate, you begin to wonder, why is it that they're different? And probably the reason is because they pointed out Jesus to you, because when you live your life for Jesus, you point back to him. And you start to point out Jesus with your life, with your words, with your actions. And when you start to have this change, it becomes an active life. Not where we just sit and hope things get better, but we are active. Because when it's active, it's powerful. When we think about God's love and God's mercy and his grace, his forgiveness, we should feel compelled to act on it. It's active when we choose to sacrifice our life from the world's way and we point our lives in the direction of God's way. And that doesn't mean it's going to be perfect. That doesn't mean we're not going to make mistakes. But it means we need to sacrifice. And that shows that activeness. It's active in our service to others by going out of our way for the benefit of other people. Because again, you cannot encounter Jesus and not be changed. But if you want a changed life that lasts, you have to give it up to God, to trust him with everything. Remember his love. Remember his forgiveness. Sacrifice yourself for him and for others, and serve others with your life, your words, and your actions, in your marriages, in your families, in your businesses, your schools, your relationships. Because Jesus said in John chapter 10, verse 10, that he came to give us life so that we can have it to the full. Not that it would be easy, but it would be the best life possible. But we have to do our part so that God can do his. Because the power of a changed life is found in no other place than God, our Creator, who sent his Son, Jesus, who has changed everything and who does still change.